take a 3-1 lead over the Indians. Then Cleveland came back with 3 in the 6th, but the Sox scored 3 in the 7th and held on for the win. 6-5, the Sox over Cleveland this afternoon. Tampa Bay is just wrapped up. It's 5-3 win over Texas. Texas did score 1 in the top of the 9th, but Tampa Bay held on to beat Texas 5-2 in the only 2 day games in the major leagues. The rest of the schedule under the lights, including the Cubs hosting the Dodgers and the Cardinals hosting the Astros. Top seed Maria Sharapova has taken advantage of some rare good weather in Paris to advance in the French Open. Other results in the women's division today saw second seed Anna Ivanovic advance to the third round, along with fifth seed Serena Williams and 10th seed Patty Schnieder. In the men's draw, second seed Rafael Nadal won his opening match. Novak Djokovic and fifth seed David Ferrer have won. Juan Carlos Ferraro, the 2003 Open champion, retired with leg pains while leading in his match today. Game 5 in the Boston-Detroit NBA Eastern Conference Finals tonight in Boston. Series tied at 2 wins apiece. The Red Wings can move closer to clinching another Stanley Cup championship tonight. With a win in Pittsburgh, the Wings topped the Penguins 2-0 after sweeping the first 2 games of the series. And the doctor for Olympic gold medalist Paul Hamm says yesterday's surgical procedure on Hamm's broken right hand went very well. Dr. Lawrence Lubber says Hamm could be doing resistance exercises within a week and that he hopes to see the gymnast competing for a medal in China. More trouble for the Bulls forward, Joakim Noah. Authorities in Florida say that he also got 2 traffic citations over the weekend after his arrest for having marijuana and an open container of alcohol. University of Florida police say Noah was cited for driving with a suspended license and not wearing a seatbelt. That's a check of sports.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designers of the M2 on Neal mixed-use project in downtown Champaign, on the web at ratioarchitects.com.
It's 2:42. Russia and its pro-Western neighbor Georgia are teetering on the edge of a military conflict. At stake, a tiny province that wants independence from Georgia. The name of the province is Abkhazia. The province of Abkhazia has been getting economic help from Russia, and that's angering Georgians and pitting Russia against the West. NPR's Gregory Pfeiffer has more.
Abkhazia should be a paradise, a prime holiday destination under the Soviet Union. The thin strip of lush subtropical land lies where the snow-capped Caucasus Mountains descend into the warm Black Sea. But amid its palm trees, Abkhazia is a surreal land of ruined buildings, deserted villages, and a population suffering from a 15-year economic blockade. At the border with the rest of Georgia, a dilapidated horse-drawn cart ferries a handful of people over the murky Inguri River. Bored-looking, blue-helmeted Russian soldiers look on. The Russians have been here as peacekeepers since 1994, when Abkhazia split from Georgia after a bloody civil war. But Georgia accuses the Russians of siding with Abkhazia. The self-styled republic is officially recognized by no one, but Moscow has kept it alive with economic support and has issued most residents here with Russian passports. In the half-ruined capital, Suhumi, Abkhazia's deputy defense minister, Zakhan Namba, opens a shed containing parts of what he says is a high-tech Georgian unmanned reconnaissance plane his forces shot down this month. Colonel Namba says Georgian spy plane flights are a serious provocation and that his men have recently brought down 7 of the Israeli-made drones, although Tbilisi says it's lost only 1 to a Russian fighter jet last month. That's when Moscow escalated its confrontation with Georgia by deciding to establish legal ties with Abkhazia and South Ossetia, another Georgian breakaway region. Moscow accused Georgia of preparing to invade Abkhazia and sent more soldiers to the region. Georgia says Moscow is simply looking for an excuse to start a war. School children in fatigue sing a patriotic song during marching drills in the center of Suhumi. The Abkhaz are a separate ethnic group from the Georgians. And after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Tbilisi accused them of wanting to secede. Georgian troops sacked Suhumi in 1992. Like many residents, Guri Kichba says soldiers looted her family's apartment.
It's amazing they didn't kill us. After that, our sons felt they had no choice but to protect our homes. Many went to fight armed only with sticks.
Kichba's son was killed during the conflict. The following year, the Abkhaz retook the region and the Georgians retreated. Mass atrocities were carried out on both sides. Hundreds of thousands of ethnic Georgians were forced to flee Abkhazia. After Georgia's pro-Western president Mikhail Saakashvili took power in 2003, he vowed to reunite Abkhazia with Georgia. But Abkhaz President Sergei Bagapsh says his government refuses even to consider Georgia's recent offer of autonomy because Tbilisi has lost any moral authority to rule Abkhazia. The Abkhaz people almost disappeared before the war, he says. The only option for our survival is full independence. The Abkhaz say they fought for centuries against the Georgians and the Russians. And Foreign Minister Sergei Shamba says he has no illusions about Moscow's motives today. The Kremlin is furious over NATO's promise last month to someday accept former Soviet Georgia as a member. We're a small people, Shamba says, and it's the weakest who are blown away by the world's political winds. We have to find help, he says, wherever we can. Abkhazia's leaders say the West has so far refused to listen to their arguments, but they cite the precedent set by Kosovo. One day, they say, the international community will have to realize the only way to avert war over Abkhazia is to recognize its independence. Gregory Pfeiffer, NPR News, Suhumi.
At a time when many states are putting more money into the arts, Illinois is going in a different direction. Funding cuts in the past year came without warning and are having an impact on those whose role it is to educate and enlighten. Sean Crawford reports.
These are tough times for the Springfield Ballet Company, but the show must go on. Cuts to state arts grants means organizations like the ballet have had to reduce how much they spend for costumes, lighting, even shoes. Julie Guttis is the group's artistic director.
We've had to reach out to our donor pool, which has been pretty consistent for the past, 35 years that the ballet company's been around. And luckily, they have really stepped up and helped us out. And I think once people understand that Illinois state government is not funding the arts like it has in the past, they really get out their checkbooks and are helping the causes.
Those who've stepped up and filled in the financial gap for the ballet have allowed the performances to continue, but that donor pool is limited, and around Illinois, these are dark days for the arts community. A 25% cut in state money for the Illinois Arts Council impacted all sorts of cultural institutions, including public broadcasting. The governor made the cut, seen by some as part of the ongoing feud with the House Speaker, whose wife chairs the Arts Council. But the Illinois Humanities Council grants also took a hit. Museums and other groups were denied funding from off-track betting proceeds, money set aside for the arts since OTBs were first introduced. The loss of money has been especially hard for those who rely almost entirely on government funding. Karen Everingham is associate director of the Illinois Association of Museums. She says Illinois has nearly 1,000 museums, most of which are small operations.
The local history is in the small museums. The local heritage is there. And that is, those are the collections that are at most risk. And cutting all this money is really going to hurt these small guys. The bigger guys, they'll probably be okay. It's the little guys that are really going to take the hit from all this, these cuts.
Everingham serves as a statewide coordinator and helps provide training to museums. Yet she says she might soon be without a job unless budget cuts are restored. Terry Scroggum has heard plenty of stories. He's director of the Illinois Arts Council. Scroggum says unless Illinois comes through with more money for the arts, groups are going to face some difficult choices.
And they would have to look into, do we change our emphasis? Do we cut out a program? Do we lay off staff? are we no longer able to, afford to provide, transportation for school groups to come view a performance or an exhibit, that kind of thing.
We do have a planetarium.
Rachel Vickay is with the Lakeview Museum of Arts and Sciences in Peoria. It's a nonprofit, and funding reductions are taking a toll there, such as cutting back hours. Vickay says when museums and similar facilities are unable to fill their mission, the public suffers.
Sometimes it's real easy to forget, oh yeah, there's a museum down the street. It's real important that we have a connection within our own community, within our own block. And I think it's really important for the legislators and the people in charge of the state governments to realize that, and they need to support it.
Another arts advocacy organization, the Illinois Arts Alliance, recently performed a survey which found nearly 3 out of 4 groups around the state are having to make cuts due to loss of state funds. That can result in a broader impact for the state's economy, including a drop in tourism. But while the arts makes its pitch to state politicians, the line is already a long one. Education, healthcare, and many other worthy causes all want more government money. It would seem a tough sell when the state has limited resources to spread around, but Bert Gray, head of the Decatur Arts Council, has his argument ready.
Study after study shows that kids who have arts education in school do better in math and science and reading. I mean, this is an era where you want kids to do really well on tests. People who are experienced in the arts as a part of their educational experience do better on tests.
The biggest concern for most arts organizations is going forward, whether political motives will play a role in their ability to operate, and can they count on the state to come through each year. In the past year, across the country, only 3 states decreased their investment in the arts. Illinois was one of them. The plan for the arts community now is to continue enlightening patrons and also state leaders. I'm Sean Crawford.
The French company Beneteau is the world's top maker of sailboats. 50 years ago, it started out as just a small family-run business making fishing boats. Here's reporter Eleanor Beardsley with a profile of the woman who transformed Beneteau into a global success story.
Never mind that Beneteau is the leading player in the multi-million dollar sailing industry. The company's headquarters still sit on the waterfront in the quiet Atlantic Coast fishing village of Saint-Gilles-Croix-de-Vie. It was here that Benjamin Beneteau began making tuna boats and trawlers in the 1880s. Almost a century later, the company changed course in the hands of Beneteau's granddaughter, 21-year-old Annette Beneteau Roux. Under her stewardship, Beneteau has grown from 17 to 6,000 employees.
Oui, vous savez, c'est très personnel, en fait.
You have to put yourself in the context of the 1960s and the decline of the fishing industry. Beneteau would have disappeared like many companies. My husband told me even though I was a girl of 21, I could still run the company. So we came out with the first pleasure boat. The rest is history.
The 65-year-old grand dame of yachting officially stepped down as Beneteau's CEO 3 years ago, but Roux still commutes weekly from Paris to oversee operations. Beneteau manufactures powerboats in Poland and has a sailboat factory in Marion, South Carolina, but the rest of its boatyards are scattered across the picturesque western coastal region of France known as La Vendée. At a Beneteau woodworking plant here, 350 artisans cut and shape 20,000 interior boat parts by hand and machine. The African, Mojave, and French beechwood parts will be used in Beneteau's cabins. Plant manager Florence Goubi says Beneteau builds 10,000 boats a year. Beneteau's strength compared to its competitors is that it has been able to industrialize its operations while preserving its tradition of craftsmanship, says Goubi. At an R&D center, dozens of engineers use the same digital computer program that Boeing uses to design its airplanes. Technology like this helps Beneteau create about 19 new boat models a year. But things haven't always been so rosy. In 1986, faulty resin from one of its suppliers ruined the hulls of about 1,000 boats. The crisis nearly sunk Beneteau. Annette Beneteau Roux pursued the supplier in court for 7 years until she got a full settlement. Then she nursed the company's battered image back to life by launching a new series of sailboats showcasing the work of big-name interior designers. By 1995, Beneteau was ready to acquire its largest competitor, fellow French company Jeanneau. Roux attributes the company's success over the long term to what she calls Beneteau's soul.
It hasn't always been easy, but I've always had faith in the deep know-how in this company. We have values that go back to our beginning, almost like genes.
Today, on a 103-acre Beneteau boatyard, the largest in the world, fiberglass hulls are being reinforced with fiberglass.